It's the Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It was a murder case that went cold for over three decades until developments in DNA forensic technology changed everything, leading investigators and lab technicians to the killer. But it wasn't just technology that solved the murder of 23-year-old Catherine Janet Walsh. It was also the dogged determination of a Monaca police officer named Andrew Gall, a rookie cop in 1979, when he discovered Ms. Walsh's lifeless body in her apartment on the Saturday of Labor Day weekend. Even when the case stalled, Gall remained committed to finding Walsh's killer, which eventually happened after the case was reopened in 2010. The story is chronicled in a new book called Justice Delayed, The Catherine Janet Walsh Story by Steve Halleck. Mr. Halleck is the director of Point Park's School of Communications graduate programs, and he joins us in studio. Steve Halleck, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Good to be here, Paul. Thank you.
Who was Catherine Janet Walsh, and what happened to her?
Catherine was a secretary at a local refrigeration company, air conditioning company in Monaca. And actually, Andrew Gall didn't discover her body so much as the really tragic part is it's her mother and father who came into her bedroom and found her dead. After she had not shown up at work, her boss started calling friends, calling them, and they tried to get in touch with her. Finally, she was living in her grandmother's apartment, so they had a key to it. And finally, they went and knocked on the door. It was locked. And they went in and found her. Nothing was in disarray. Everything was neat and tidy. Then they went into the bedroom and found her under a sheet, dead.
And there was nothing particularly that anybody was aware of that was going on in her life that would have indicated that her parents would find something like this?
Nothing at all. The only thing that was amiss in her life was she was separated from her husband. It was their second separation. So they were estranged, and that's why she'd moved into her own apartment. And that's what fascinated me about this case is it turned into such a mystery. The police interviewed five really what they considered strong suspects within a period of about a couple of days, then a fifth one 2 years later. And they each had either and or motive and opportunity. So it was just an enigma. It was a mystery to them.
And so this rookie Monaca police officer named Andrew Gall, he's the first law enforcement representative to see her after she has been murdered. And you write that this isn't the first time that he has seen a dead body, but that seeing this particular dead woman had a profound effect on him. Why? Why this woman? Why this situation?
Well, he'd experienced a couple fatalities in his young career, but he'd never seen anything like this. In fact, a lot of rookie or veteran police officers have not seen something like this. When he walked in, this is the scene that the father and mother found. When he walked in, he found her under a sheet on her belly, and her hands were tied behind her back by a tie cord of a bathrobe, and she had a blue bandana around her neck, which was used to strangle her. Her body was bruised, but it wasn't the sort of bruising you get from a beating. It was more of the bruising that are part of being strangled. And she was half nude. She had a nightie on her top, and it was just a gory, gory scene. And yeah, he'd never seen anything like that. And I think really what committed him to this was the man who greeted him at the door was her father. And right away, Andrew Gall developed a relationship with her father, and he just became connected to this case, which is why he stayed with it for so long, even as he moved away from the Monaca Police Department and on to other law enforcement agencies in Beaver County. He and her father, Peter Coultry, kept in touch, and he promised her father that he was going to find the person who did this.
And he couldn't have known it at the time, but this ends up becoming Officer Andrew Gall's life work because it takes him over 30 years to crack the case.
Mm-hmm.
So when he makes this promise, he may not even know it at the time, but he's saying that I'm going to devote three decades of my life or more to solving this.
Whatever it would take. He was determined that before he ended his career, this case was going to be solved. And when DNA came along in the 2000s, It was kind of slow coming to Monaca and to Beaver County, but they finally resubmitted the evidence, the clothing they found and the sheets, et cetera, for DNA testing. And one of the state police officers testified later in court that when he got the phone call, he got a phone call from the lab that just buckled his knees because the woman told him, you know, you're not going to believe it, but we found sperm all over the place. And, of course, that brings the DNA. And then they knew that all they had to do was get a sample of their five suspects' DNA and see if they could get a match, and they did.
So that was the primary reason why the case had been so difficult to solve, or were there other reasons?
No, it was because the suspects they had, you know, they included her ex-husband, her estranged husband. They never got divorced. Her estranged husband, her employer, sort of a mysterious man who had shown up at a nightclub where she was the night before she was murdered, another stranger in town who showed up 2 years later and knew all the details of the death and claimed to have been dating her, and the man who was eventually convicted, who it turned out we didn't know this, nobody knew it. Well, the police knew it, but they couldn't do anything with it. They were having a secret affair. He would come over to her house at midnight or 1 a.m, and nobody but she and he knew this affair was going on until she confided in a close friend of hers.
And we'll look at more of the details about the case and also what inspired you to write the book. We're talking with Steve Halleck. He is the author of Justice Delayed, the Catherine Janet Walsh story. We need to work in another break, so we'll do that now and return to talk about this case and the writing of this very compelling book. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and I'm talking with Steve Halleck. He's the author of the book Justice Delayed, the Catherine Janet Walsh story, about the murder of a 23-year-old woman in Monaca that went unsolved for over three decades. And Steve, I was watching a CNN special about the murder of John Lennon last night and thinking about how long it's been since that shooting took place in December of 1980. But the murder of Catherine Janet Walsh goes back even further to 1979. It was a long, long time ago, and as tragic as any murder is, and certainly the murder of John Lennon was, we knew right away who did it. But this had to have been tremendously agonizing, not just for the family and for the people directly involved, like Detective Gall, but also the people of that town. You know, this was a woman that they knew, that they had crossed paths with, and really didn't know who she was killed by. And that had to be terribly disconcerting for that period of time in a small, close-knit town like Monaca.
Well, Monaca was, a close-knit town, and nobody could remember in their memory a murder occurring in the community. It's extremely rare in Monaca, and so it was quite a shock, especially her family, but her neighbors and friends. But during my research, I discovered that Monaca was a sort of community where people didn't lock their doors at night. They'd frequently leave their garage doors open at night. And after this happened, there was a fear that there was a strangler at large in the community because they had no idea who might have done this. So it became a paranoid community and a frightened community, and people began locking their doors and closing their garages.
Who is Gregory Scott Hopkins?
Gregory Scott Hopkins, at the time, was a construction. He owned his own small construction company. He built modular homes, and he built the home that Janet and her husband bought in Upper Monaca. There's a Lower Monaca and an Upper Monaca, and they bought the home from another buyer who bought it from him. She got to know him because her neighbor in her new home worked for Mr. Hopkins, cleaning the houses he had built, cleaning them and getting them ready for sale. And she started hanging out with her and going and eating lunch with her at work. And then her neighbor, Margie Farinacci, introduced her to Gregory Scott Hopkins. And he took it from there.
Yeah, well, he was the guy that Detective Gall figured this is the guy.
Not at the time.
Not right away, but eventually he figures it out, right?
He was high on his radar because when the police first interviewed Hopkins, they were having trouble getting a straight story from him. He first denied having known her, and then, oh yes, I knew her, and then because they already knew that she and he were involved in a sexual relationship, he finally admitted to that. So he was kind of evasive. So that's what raised Gall's radar, was the evasive nature of this guy during the interviews. But he was not yet ready to be a prime suspect because he had three really strong alibis. Three people who had spent the night with him the night before getting ready for a Labor Day picnic for his employees. So they didn't even bother to polygraph him. They polygraphed every other suspect, but not him because of the strong alibi he had.
And then after the case was reopened, was the fact that Gregory Scott Hopkins was a Bridgewater councilman, did that make him, in some minds, above suspicion? Because in the meantime, he had established himself in the community as one of the leaders.
It made him above suspicion in the eyes of the community. But as far as the law enforcement officials were considered, and especially Gall, that didn't alter their thinking at all because they had other kinds of evidence. And it actually helped that he was a councilman because it's really interesting the way they got a sample of his DNA because he refused to give it.
Right. Officer Gall, I want to set this up by mentioning that he keeps trying to lure Hopkins into a situation where he will leave his DNA somewhere, somehow, on a, you know, his fingers around a cup. You know, they offer him a cup of coffee and he's like, nope, I've brought my own water. You know, and then he takes the empty water bottle with him.
Right.
So he knows what's up, and right. he keeps evading the police.
Right. Then one of the council members, the chief of police in Bridgewater says, well, you know, because he's on the council, he comes in here sometimes and gets a drink of water and throws the cup away. So the chief of police waited until Hopkins came and took his next drink of water, and then he fished the cup out of the trash and took the cup to gave it to Gall to take to the lab for testing, and they got enough of a match to justify a search warrant to force him to give a good DNA sample, and they had a strong match.
So that's where the break in the case comes.
Yep.
And then what happens next?
Well, then he's arrested, and this really shocked the community because, as you pointed out, he was a member of the council. He'd done some charity work, construction work for people in the community. He shoveled the borough's office walks. He was a highly respected guy, and he was a charming guy. And the people who knew him, they were just shocked by this. But when you get into the court and you have the testimony, you have the evidence, and the case just was under its own movement then toward conviction.
And the circumstances and the reason why he was so evasive was that Detective Gall concluded was that this was a night of sex that had gone wrong. It wasn't that this guy came over with the intent of murdering this woman.
That's Detective Gall's theory, is that they're engaged in this kind of kinky sex, strangulation-type sex, where bondage, that sort of thing, and that it had gotten out of hand, and it was accidental. In fact, he told me in an interview after the case was done that had Hopkins at the time just said, you know, we're involved in this kind of relationship, and it was something that gone bad, it was an accident, he could have gotten out with a misdemeanor and probably would have even gotten probation. But he didn't take that route.
He lied about it to the point where he said, I wasn't even there. And when the verdict came, after this case went to trial, Gall says it was the only time he cried in the courtroom.
Yes.
It was. You can only imagine after three decades. Did he convey to you just the level of, I wouldn't say euphoria would be the right word, but just this emotional release that he must have had after working toward this for over three decades?
I tried real hard to get inside his head, but when you get to know Andrew Gall, you get to know a guy who's pretty soft-spoken. He's very easygoing, very methodical. He's not a guy who shows his emotions. He just does not show them. So for him to cry in the courtroom was quite dramatic. And his strongest comment about the case when we talked about it afterwards was, this is the one I'm going to tell my grandkids about. This is the case that was the case of my life. He obviously felt strongly about it. I think what was most meaningful for him was when he was able to go to her father and tell her, we've arrested a suspect. We've got the guy. And her father just said, come on in. We're going to have some pie.
And why did Detective Gall stay on the case? What kept him going even after the case went really cold?
I think it's his connection to Peter Coultry, her father. They just connected to the point where over the years they would talk to each other about their families and about their kids. And when he made that promise early in the case to the father that we're going to get this solved. So even when he went on to other police and county sheriff jurisdictions, or the district attorney jurisdictions as a detective, they gave him time to keep working on this case. They made sure that he could take this case with him. And that's unusual that the officer will carry a case from jurisdiction to jurisdiction like that.
What made you want to write about this case?
I was reading the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette one day, and there was just a brief story in there about a preliminary hearing coming up. And in one paragraph in there, it mentioned the original responding officer, Andrew Gall, who had stayed with this case for 30 years, more than 30 years. And, you know, I've read Les Misérables about the cop, Javert, who chased the guy who stole a loaf of bread for a long, long career. And I thought, this is a story. I got to find out why this guy, how this guy stayed with this, what drives this guy to stay with this case. So that's what originally prompted me to get in touch with them and pursue this story.
And we're down to just about a minute left, but you use all the characters' real name in this book. Except
all but one.
Mm-hmm. Except one. Who and why?
I can't use his name because in my he's been used in other venues, his name. But in my investigation, I learned there was so much more about him that other questionable parts of his past that were I to use his real name and print these other questionable aspects of his past, he could have maybe a good case of libel against me. I had information in this book that was not published anywhere else, so I made the decision to change his name to Carlo so that my publisher wouldn't be sued.
And he's that suspect. There's always the one suspect that throws you off the scent, and Carlo is that guy in this book.
He came along 2 years later, and at the time he became Gall's top suspect because he walked into a diner downtown one night, and he was trying to put some moves on the waitress, and she wouldn't go out with him. She was married, and he said, well, I just want to let you know, I know that girl who was murdered. I knew her, and he started giving her some details of the case that she got a little frightened, and she went straight to the police and told them about this guy, and he turned out to be a pretty strong suspect.
It's a story that takes all sorts of twists and turns, and it's a great read. The book is called Justice Delayed, the Catherine Janet Walsh story by my guest, Steve Halleck, who is director of Point Park School of Communications graduate programs. He joined us in studio. Steve Halleck, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
I enjoyed being here. Thank you.
Tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh, Congressman Tim Murphy joins us to talk about a House bill that was very important to him and should be to the nation in the wake of the tragedy that occurred 3 years ago this month. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.